policy signs is
important. Interview with Albert Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R, former governor of Alabama, July 9th, 1974.
One of the questions that we ask is there a difference between the South as compared with the other regions of the country? Are there really Southern qualities or characteristics that differentiate it from the rest of the country?
I think it would be difficult for anyone in the South to answer that unless he had lived in other parts of the country or had had broad experience in other parts of the country. We're told, and we think, that fundamentally Southerners tend to have greater feeling for people, that is, to be perhaps more outgoing generally, personality, to perhaps seek out and make friends more readily, to enjoy a more harmonious personal relationship perhaps than we think of as existing in the urban areas in the north and east. But it's inconceivable to me to think that people in the South have any greater concern for the future, or for their children, or for the education they'll get, or for the economic opportunity they'll enjoy, than people do anywhere. I think that whether it's because of climate, or heredity, or habit, or custom, or what it might be, that the way of life in the South is perhaps more leisurely, less hurried, but that would be because, or contributed at least, by less density of population and world factors like that. People, I'm thinking South, people generally are emotional. The people in the South may be emotional about other issues. People in the South traditionally have had a strong sense of history, pride, perhaps in their forebears and what has gone before. And many in the South have had instilled in them perhaps a pride in an era a century ago that if they, or perhaps I should say we, had in fact lived then, we would have been not a part of the ruling caste in which we express pride today. It's a strange thing. I can't believe that fundamentally there's a difference in people and their ambitions and wishes and problems and desires, but there might be a difference in their way of life.
Could you sketch for just your own political background?
Yes, I was elected to the legislature in 1954.
You were how old then?
25, and served in the State House 3 terms. I was Speaker of the House my 3rd term, and then ran for and was elected Lieutenant Governor in 1966. Served there until 68, when Mrs. Wallace died, and I succeeded to the office of governor and served there until 71. Since then, I've been a private citizen, but still interested in public life.
During that period of time, what are the basic political changes that have occurred in the state?
Really remarkable. Like a roller coaster. I think back to when I was in law school, in undergraduate school, I was interested in politics, of course, and I can recall then that the state was probably a pretty good example of populism. Governor Folsom was governor when I finished high school, actually, and so during all the years when my interest in politics was whetted most strongly, he was in office. I can remember the emphasis at that time was economic, massive road building programs, the evidenced interest in old people, their old age pension programs, and things of this nature, social welfare programs that were very fundamental, sophisticated programs such as Medicaid and things of the present era were just unthought of then. But we went through that period. I can remember the first time I voted in a political campaign, in a presidential campaign. I voted for Stevenson, who carried Alabama handily. Probably the certainly as liberal, if not more so in the strict sense of the word, as McGovern, yet he carries Alabama overwhelmingly against a popular military hero figure, Eisenhower. Supreme Court decision in 54 in Brown was in my first campaign, and the court had not ruled. It ruled in late May, and the primary was in early May, but all the candidates were running against the anticipated ruling even then. But in spite of that and all the furor about it, in 56, Stevenson carried Alabama again, handily, over Nixon. I mean, over Eisenhower. And then in 60, still, Kennedy got, we had one of those crazy situations with our independent electors. We then had 11 electoral votes. Five of the 11 electors defected and voted for someone else, but six of the 11 voted for Kennedy. But the Democratic ticket carried the state in the Kennedy-Nixon race in 60. And again, rather handily, the Democratic electors were elected. I'm honest, I don't recall now whether they were committed publicly, some for Kennedy and some uncommitted, so to speak, or had lined up, but the people voted the rooster, as we call it then anyway. That was in 60, and we'd already had some violence. We'd had the Authorine Lucy incident at the university in 56 when she was admitted, attended class for 3, 4, 5 days, and then was expelled. But a lot of feeling then. No difference. Election-wise, we were still on the pocketbook issues, so to speak. Then, of course, in 64, with Goldwater, it all flip-flopped. But we made the gamut from traditional populist politics there 25 years ago in a period of about 15 years and rather dramatically to the quote New South or the Southern strategy or whatever we might want to call it. But we saw the influx of racial politics in the electorate in 58. Race played a significant part in the governor's race in Alabama. There were other factors to be sure, but this was a factor. In 54, Governor Folsom, who enjoyed such black support as there was then, and I remember this vividly, when he was questioned about his attitude on integration of public schools. passed it off by saying that he wasn't going to make little black children go to school with white children. He stated the reverse of it in a way that really minimized the detrimental effect on either group. In 58, Patterson was elected with undertones of, strong undertone. In fact, Wallace, whom he defeated that year, accused him of having the support of the Ku Klux Klan and made that the primary issue in the runoff. But it was not so significant then. In 62, Wallace took that mantle and carried it. And of course, it stayed dominant, really, until a couple of years ago.
So when did that change?
It's hard
to say.
Was it
the primary consideration in your campaign?
Yes, it was dominant in ours in 70, so the change has been since then.
Do you see it operating at all at the state level now, as an open?
The racial issue, not as an open factor. It's still there beneath the surface. But to what extent, I don't know. There's still a great deal of racial feeling or animosity in the state. I hear casual comments all the time, and you will if you're around a few days, when statements are made that are racially disparaging. It may be criticism of a court order in a school case. It may be criticism of a black being in a restaurant or in a room with a white hospital or just any number of places. You hear these things. They're there. They're basic human feelings, I suppose. But as a factor in political races now, I'm just not sure. It's strange how integrated work conditions, plants, factories, and so forth, may have accelerated some of this feeling. It may have cast races together in circumstance conditions where they had never been exposed to each other before and might not have developed feeling had they not been exposed that way. But I'm not certain that it's so much racial as it is just human nature. Some people get along with other people and some don't. It's strange how well the school situation has gone in the South.
So you feel that the systematic exploitation of that issue in 70 was the principal reason for your defeat?
Yes.
But you think it could be done again today?
No.
So then, not much of a change in attitude in 4 years?
Yes.
How do you explain that?
I think people are tired of it. In fact, I think the people realized, enough people realized, that they had been had, so to speak. That they had been used, or themselves exploited through fear. And people are afraid of the unknown. That they had been exploited, in effect, by the racial issue. And I think there was some resentment of it when it was all over on the part of people. When you run into things like, I remember one of the most effective.
But how do you feel about that person? You, in effect, really were the last person to really be, in a sense, exploited on that issue. Now it's not a dead issue, but in terms of an open public debate, it's gone.
How do I feel about that?
How do you feel about it?
But of course, in a sense, I feel that perhaps we have to end it. That maybe the approach we took helped end it. You know, it was a strange thing in Alabama prior to 1970. No candidate dared give bumper stickers to blacks to put on their cars. He didn't dare solicit their support. In fact, if they were supporting him, he asked them to keep it quiet, please, because this would be utilized. I remember vividly the day that someone from our campaign staff came in the spring of 1970 and said, we've got a horrible decision to make. We're getting ready to put bumper sticker crews out here. And these blacks are going to want bumper stickers on their cars. What do we do with them? And I said, you put them on. And it was such a simple thing. And today, you know, you wouldn't say put them on. You'd say beg them to take them, like you do everybody else. But then this was a major decision because of the feared effect of it politically. The thing that really was devastating to us was not so much an open campaign to all the people and put it on that basis, but radio advertising. And you may have heard of one particular one, a voice comes on in a sort of an undertone and says, how would you like for your wife to be stopped on a dark night on a lonely road by a black state trooper? And this sort of thing, you know, and to play on the fears of the people. Just what sort of fears, I guess. And it was effective. And it was told and advertised that if I were elected in 70 that we'd have black state troopers all over Alabama. Or that if, it's got to be a joke really, they would say, if you vote for Brewer, you're going to have black state troopers all over Alabama. And the fellow told me about a year later, he said, well, I voted for you, and sure enough, we got black state troopers all over Alabama. But a court order had something to do with that, too. It was effective. The strange thing is that where it was most effective was in the overwhelmingly white counties of the state. We carried every black belt county, whether blacks went a majority or not, but where the heavy populations of blacks were, we carried them. These were the people who lived with them, associated with blacks daily, and all this sort of thing, knew that there was nothing to fear. But in the predominantly white counties, and many of them in the mountainous rural areas where there were no blacks at all, we'd just get beat to pieces. It was on the race issue, which is a real strange thing.
Would you do it differently though?
No, we wouldn't run the campaign any differently, because from the standpoint of taking a different position on this subject, it'd be impossible to serve effectively, I think, if you ran that kind of campaign. It's a divisive sort of thing. In fact, it's devastating to a state. And of course, it's one of the reasons why our state has lagged so far behind all these years. Spend so much time fighting each other and fighting imaginary enemies and these hidden fears and everything that we have, that we've been unable to do things that needed to be done.
Well, you think that that issue...
I would do some things differently, don't get me wrong, but insofar as it approaches to issues, they'd be the same. We'd emphasize some issues.
Does the removal of that issue mean the state's going to turn a corner on some of these other problems?
No, not necessarily. The big problem, that, as I see it, and my theory is that the difference in states like Alabama and North Carolina has been leadership. North Carolina did things in the 30s that we're just now doing. It's remarkable. North Carolina had leadership that might have been criticized then, but had the foresight to borrow money and build highways and develop educational institutions and all this sort of thing that just goes with economic growth. And some of the states weren't doing it. Now, I know we're told that North Carolina is more prosperous than we are and all that sort of thing. I dare say this was not true in the 30s. There wasn't any prosperity in the 30s anyway in the South. But it takes leadership with vision to do things. It takes some boldness. It takes some daring. So much leadership, and I have a theory about this, tries to find out which way the masses are going and then runs around and gets in front of them. Instead of by persuasiveness and ingenuity and ability of leading the masses in the way that they ought to go. And I think this has been the difference in the have and have not states in the South.
It's going to be the both economic and long-range political effect of the Tennessee Tom Bigby project.
It could be tremendous. I'm not an economist, and I'm not sure that any of those fellows are reliable, because I know when we were working on the initial construction program, that is trying to get funds from Congress for actual construction, the states, and their five who make up the compact and who contribute toward the support of the compact, would hire economists whose purpose was to show the cost-benefit ratio and how attractive the project was. Well, of course, those figures were all slanted in favor of the folks who were paying the bill. This is something that you hire experts for. I think it's impossible to determine, but just on the surface, it opens up the entire mid-continent United States to the Port of Mobile in a real selfish way. Mobile ought to be one of the 10 largest ports and one of the 10 busiest ports in the country with the completion of this waterway. And with the demands that we have on energy, on transportation facilities, and I'm thinking particularly now of rail, this offers a very attractive alternative. It ought to open the region up for industrial development, not just in Alabama and Mississippi, but on through to the Midwest, because of the access through the waterway to the entire world.
Thinking back to your point about Alabama not having the leadership that some of the other states have had, but it's basically been the Wallaces since 1963.
Oh, no.
A couple of years.
I'm thinking on back to the 30s when people were doing...
Well, what about since 62? How do you assess that period?
I think it's been an improved time. I'd say since World War II it's been an improved time. World War II was good for states like Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia and the deep southern states. The young people saw the world. They saw this country and they saw the entire world. And they saw, they associated with people from everywhere. And they saw another side to life. And they saw a great many advantages that we didn't enjoy here. And many of them came back determined that things were going to be better. I really think, prior to World War II, the leadership in Alabama had been very conservative. The politics of the state were dominated by the Black Belt, the landed gentry, so to speak, in association with a few selfish business interests. And they wanted a laissez-faire governor. And legislature and everything else. Just maintain the status quo. This was fine. Most of our lack of industrial development came from a lack of any desire for new industry and new people moving in and all this sort of thing. One of the strongest supporters of the Tennessee Valley Authority I know, one of the most progressive people I know, a fellow in North Alabama who fought TVA bitterly, just with every resource at his command, quite a prominent citizen, and he was just bitter about it. He said David Lilienthal came to Decatur one day and came to see him to express to him the purposes of the Tennessee Valley Authority. And he said when he came in his office, he resigned it, said to Lilienthal, "Well, what are you going to do for us?" And Lilienthal said, "Not a damn thing. We're going to make it possible for you to do something for yourselves." And over the years, that area of the state, I think, has been a leader in Alabama, in showing what could be done.
But you're saying that World War II produced a group of leaders that had an impact on the state's government?
I think so, yes, no question about it. And perhaps more than that, not just leaders, but citizens who were interested and were willing to try to wrest control of things away from these who had dominated politics. Jim Folsom's election was an example. He was elected in 46, primarily by the veteran vote. Jim was a clown. He campaigned that way. I don't mean he was a clown mentally now, very smart man. But he was a showman, and he campaigned that way. And with the end of the war, and everyone had a happy, carefree attitude, and he just fit right into the mold. And his primary opposition was a tool of those who had controlled government and the state for a long time. And the masses just elected Jim. He really got them interested. He was the first campaigner who ever really went to the people, the stump campaigning. Now he called it to the branch heads. But he'd do political rallies, you know, four or five a day, and they'd be in the rural communities rather than in the cities. And people just flocked from miles around to hear it. But it brought people closer to government and gave them a sense of someone being interested in them and caring about them. And it had to be good. And Wallace does this. Until he was injured, he had a tremendous capacity for attracting a feeling on the part of people that they had a stake in government. The government was interested in them. Admittedly, he a lot of times gained their interest by setting up straw men to attack and joining with the people against the common enemy, whether it be the New York Times or Federal Civil Rights Acts, or whatever it might be. Take whatever enemy or adversary who's convenient at the time when you want to rally the people together, but it's a very effective thing. Jim Folsom did it to some extent with the Godrocks and folks like this. He always ran against the Black Belt, plantation owners or the land barons in his heyday. Made the people feel that this was a group seeking to oppress the masses of people. But that's more of a strategy thing. I see this emerging. We didn't have 9-month school in Alabama till after World War II. That is a mandatory 9-month school term in every school system until after World War II. In those years, in the first decade after World War II, a great many people, young people, got interested in politics, came to the legislature. They were concerned about things like education, industrial development, highways, and they could just see how massive government involvement and programs of this kind help build a state. We're convinced of it. I know we had seen it in my hometown, and Decatur didn't get a new industry until 1948, I suppose. But when we got one, everyone felt it, knew what it meant, and liked it, and liked the idea.
How do you assess the state of the Republican Party in Alabama?
Negligible.
Has it come and gone?
No, I don't think that. It's fragmented. It's afflicted with the little jealousies, envies that permeate organizations. I start to say small organizations, I just say organizations. It has had some attractive candidates and has been able to hold those people, like the three congressmen who are very able, Buchanan, Edwards, and Dickinson. They're very able, they're very popular with the people. Probably of the three, only Edwards has a genuinely Republican constituency, that is a majority in the Mobile district. So many people in Alabama have left the traditional Democratic umbrella and now call themselves independent, and I think this is a national phenomenon, too. The Goldwater thing in 64 helped bring this to bear. It helped create this sort of climate. People didn't really want to call themselves Republicans, they said they were independents. There was some of this in 52 with Eisenhower, 56. They were called Eisenhower Democrats. Still only a few Republicans, but a great many Eisenhower Democrats or independents as they evolved. I don't know what the, if we had a party registration bill or law in Alabama, we'd probably find maybe 100, 150,000 registered Republicans. They don't have primaries generally. And if people who would like to say they're Republicans want to participate in government, they have to vote in the Democratic primary, or else they're precluded. And so they're sort of half and half.
The Democratic Party still operates the primary, isn't it?
Yes. The Republicans had a statewide primary 2 years ago when Blunt ran for the Senate against or for the Republican nomination and got it, and then opposed Sparkman in the general election. That's the first statewide primary I believe they've had. They've had county primaries before and did this year, but I believe that's the first statewide primary. And it was disappointing. Goodness, there must have been 60,000 votes cast in the primary. Republican primary, the Democratic primary probably had, I would guess offhand, 900,000 votes cast.
How would you characterize the Democratic Party in Alabama? Some say it's got ideological factions, some say it's a geographical split north and south, some say it's lawless anti-laws. How would you characterize it?
Probably some of all of those things. The fundamental thing goes back to 48. To the Dixiecrat thing. After 48, the old line Democrats, so-called Yellow Dog Democrats, undertook to purge the Dixiecrats. And in 52, adopted a loyalty oath. Those who had not voted the Democratic ticket could not run in a Democratic primary, which is an interesting thing. It's how I got in politics. I had a real good friend who we were trying to get to run for the legislature in 54, and he finally confessed that he couldn't run because he had voted for Eisenhower in 52, and he couldn't take the oath. And so it devolved upon me to run for this place that was open up in our section. So. This was part of it. Well, the loyalists, so-called, got control at that time and have maintained it to this day. There's been a lack of general interest in the committee. Many instances, the same people have remained on the committee, and the loyalists have just maintained control, so-called loyalists, who now have both groups, the Dixiecrat group has come a great deal toward the middle and is now more in a posture of wanting to work within the framework of the National Party. The Loyalists primarily were hung up on the idea that the people of Alabama were denied the right to vote for the Democratic nominee for president. I wasn't old enough in 48 to vote for president, but if I had been, I could not have voted for Harry Truman for president. And there's something to say for this sort of argument. In 68, the Democrats had to come in under a third-party label to get Humphrey on the ticket, where people in Alabama could even vote for him for president. So this has been their hang-up. Well, now, as they have accommodated themselves perhaps more, and as the Dixiecrats have evolved more toward at least working within the framework of the National Party, you find that there's not such a great variety of interest. A lot of the difficulty now may just be pure habit. And I think the reason for the split this spring on the election of a chairman would be, one, distrust by the Wallaces, by the loyalist of Wallace. He might say right now he's within the framework, but the background, they're wondering if things don't go right, if he'll take his ball and bat and go back to his third party home and leave them out in the cold again. So they're scared to go too far in accommodating him for fear they'll lose it all. And at the same time, as a matter of pride, the Wallace supporters feel like the governor's titular head of the party ought to have a voice in the selection of the chairman.
Yeah, Vance's election was a clear defeat for Wallace.
It certainly was.
Why don't people read it that way?
But two reasons. One, there's just not much interest in it. And two, the press really hasn't laid it out like that.
But it is the case.
Oh, sure, sure.
What does that mean to you? I mean, here he was just renominated at the height of his popularity. Yet in that executive committee could not bring off the election of his own chairman.
Well, I'm not sure it can mean one of two things. Either he didn't do his homework, because it's inconceivable to me that a governor who wants to couldn't elect his chairman of a committee. Either didn't do his homework, or he got some real bad advice. The two may not be that much different. They were involved, I know, in the elections, trying to elect people friendly to Wallace to the committee, trying to get control of the committee. Reapportionment helped the Vance forces in many respects, because reapportionment established some predominantly black districts and like this that were fairly easy for the Vance group to control. But Wallace was there at the meeting, sitting on the front row when he got clobbered. And he thought he was going to win, or believe me, he wouldn't have been at the meeting. You just don't get humiliated publicly like this. And particularly Wallace, it just doesn't happen. But no governor should. And if he does, whoever's responsible for his being there ought to have his head chopped off. He ought to be gone.
Does the fact that none of the congressional delegation were at that meeting indicate their lack of interest in the whole executive committee?
No. It indicates this to me, that if they were present, given the Wallace popularity, they'd have to be there in such a posture that it would indicate their support of him. And they didn't want to do that. And now I'm really doing some speculating. I know this would be true with some of them. With some of them, there may be other reasons. I dare say they didn't want to be there because they didn't want to be in a posture of either groups pointing the finger at them and saying, you're here to help that side, not this side. And there'd be no way, a meeting like that is like the biblical admonition, you're either for me or against me. If you're not for me, you're against me. And both sides might take that attitude. Wallace has made the job of the congressman very difficult over the years. It has probably been better for them the last 4 years than many other time the service of those who've been up there during his time, because always before, here they were, sitting on the Democratic side of the aisle, frankly, there's no other place to sit unless they sat in the aisle itself. And yet, at home, having to at least on the surface give support to him because of his immense popularity, trying to maintain the friendly relationship with the party under whose auspices and from whose caucus they received their assignments, and at the same time back home supporting what in effect was a third party or anti-democratic stance. Very difficult task for them. One that would, that Congressman Pryor, for example, would not rather face in North Carolina.
How do you assess the meaning of Senator Kennedy's visit last year?
I don't know how to assess it.
Both the meaning and the impact.
Well, I think from his standpoint, he had nothing to lose. I really feel at that point, 3 years before the convention, primaries, everything, and as I analyze his following, it's so intensely loyal that he could afford to stray occasionally without alienating them. I think his following is loyal enough that if he expressed the view that, or if they got the impression that an accommodation with Wallace was necessary to put him in the White House, that that they would tolerate it. At the same time, Wallace's following is probably of like loyalty and intensity, that they'd excuse almost anything he did. If they were convinced that it would help toward whatever end they had in mind at that time. I'm not sure that either of them could get away with an extended campaign of this kind. Kennedy got many rumblings, and Wallace got many. Who got more, I don't know, but neither, I don't think, tried to make a secret of the fact that the reaction was negative from mail and this sort of thing. Of course, folks who are upset are more likely to write you than people who are pleased. It just works this way in politics. But the blacks particularly seem to be getting increasingly concerned about willingness of some Democrats to accept Wallace. And a lot of Wallace's right-wing supporters are becoming increasingly concerned about his apparent ambition and his willingness to compromise some of the things they thought he stood for in order to gain place on the national ticket. Now, trying to equate that to terms of votes of delegates is something I can't do, and I don't think anyone else can at this time.
What do you think is the source of that immense popularity?
Wallace.
Usually, the longer the politician is around, the longer he's in office and so on, tends to go downhill.
I don't know. I really think, I know this, during my years in the legislature and in the lieutenant governor's office while Wallace was governor, or while Lurline was governor, but while he was there. He had many downs, the high points and the low points. When he got down, there'd always be a crisis of some kind.
You mean a real crisis or a perceived
crisis? It's an apparent crisis that tended to rally everyone around. Some of the out-of-state things. An appearance on Meet the Press could be enough. An attack by Richmond Flowers, who was then Attorney General of Alabama, on Wallace for something, would be enough to bring the vocal supporters back.
How did he do that? How did he, after you created this crisis, how did he rally his support around?
Well, the support rallied automatically.
Automatically.
When he, I won't say that. Much of it was contrived. Letter writing campaigns, letters to the news, to the editors, these call-in radio programs, this sort of thing, utilized very effectively. It was this idea of it's us against them. Find a common enemy somewhere, and it's us against them. All of Wallace's speeches would be how many people he spoke to at Cobo Hall in Detroit and what he told them, and that you're as cultured and refined and so forth, and all this kind of thing. And, it was a phenomenon of the time.
Doesn't that tend to exhaust people?
It does, and there's evidence of this. We had a poll made in 72. Let me say there was a poll made in 72 that we had access to. Just, I think, a week before the shooting in Maryland, Wallace's job rating was down somewhere around 50, 51, 52% favorable. It's the lowest job rating I've ever seen on an Alabama office holder, by far. Which indicated a weariness with all of this. Sort of the same thing, you know, for 8 years then, or 10. And then, just a few days after the shooting, someone who was running for office had a poll made. And the job rating was up like 85% or some outlandish figure, just like a meteor. Then in a few weeks it had leveled on back down in the 70s, where it remained through the polling period of that election year. But it was real strange. But it indicated that people had tired, had despaired perhaps somewhat. The legislature had been through an unproductive session in 71, didn't even pass appropriation bills. Arrangements were made with a bank to loan state employees money in lieu of their paychecks. They'd execute an assignment of